Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. This hour, I'm speaking with Stephen Koslin, founding dean of San Francisco's brand new university, the Minerva Schools at Keck Graduate Institute, which seeks to revolutionize higher education. What does it mean to reinvent the university experience? At Minerva, which just this fall enrolled its founding class of students, there are no classrooms, no gyms, and no libraries. The school has banned lectures of any kind and instead teaches classes through an interactive online platform designed to promote active learning and problem solving. The majority of Minerva students are from abroad, and all students, after spending their freshman year in San Francisco, move to a different international location in each subsequent year. Minerva's tuition is far lower than that of most traditional universities. It has a unique admissions process, and its professors are intensively trained in how students learn. Is Minerva the future of higher education? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues is Minerva's founding dean, Stephen Koslin. Koslin leads the School of Arts and Sciences at Minerva. He came from Stanford University, where he served as director of the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Science. Prior to that, he spent over 30 years at Harvard University in a variety of positions, including dean of social sciences. Koslin has been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and has received three honorary doctorates, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and the National Academy of Sciences Initiatives and Research Awards. He has published more than 300 scientific papers and 14 books. His most recent book, Top Brain, Bottom Brain, posits a brand new theory about how each of us thinks. He holds a PhD in psychology from Stanford University and a BA in psychology from UCLA. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, after 30-plus years at Harvard and then a stint at Stanford, what made you want to come join this brand-new startup educational institution?
For many years, I was obsessed with a single question. The question is, what shape are German Shepherd dog's ears? I'm not joking. I'm actually not that interested in the question, but rather in how people try to answer it. So when you try to answer that, what do you do?
I try to picture a dog and see if I can picture what its ears are like.
Exactly. So you visualize the shape of the animal's ears. So it's about mental imagery, and I studied that for over 30 years, and I was particularly interested in its role in thinking. And this led me to get interested in its role in learning and memory more generally. And eventually I started doing more applied kinds of things that were related to imagery and visual perception. I've written a couple of books on how you use psychological principles in PowerPoint to design PowerPoint presentations that are compelling and clear, a couple of books on visual display design, how you make graphs and so forth, using psychology. So it was a small step to thinking about the science of learning. There's a huge amount known about memory, learning, motivation, and related topics that has just obvious implications for education, and it's not being used systematically. It's just incredible.
Why not?
I think in large part because many people perceive that if it's not broken, you don't need to fix it, and they don't see a problem with how things are currently going. So when I was at Harvard, things were going really quite well, and there wasn't a sense that we needed to revise teaching methods or the like very much. So what drew me to leave Harvard and eventually Stanford to work for this startup was the promise of being able to actually systematically use the science of learning to improve people's lives. There's just no other way that one could do this. I mean, the thing about Minerva that's so amazing is we've pushed the reset button for the 21st century. We've taken a step back and said, okay, given all the stuff we know, like from the science of learning, but also about technology, what can we do to create a really efficient, enticing, stimulating, fun educational environment that'll help students learn?
Sounds like you have a laboratory to test out the ideas you had been researching.
We're extremely empirically motivated. We're evidence-based. And we will be measuring how well our techniques work. And we will be changing them in accordance with the results.
So let's talk about some of those techniques. How does Minerva work as a university? How does the learning work? How is it different than a traditional university? Students who go there, what should they expect?
Okay. So I like to think about the academic side of Minerva in terms of four distinctive characteristics. The first is what we teach. It's really different than most other universities. Most universities, you get chemistry and English and history and sort of traditional subjects, and they kind of hope that you're going to pick up critical thinking and creative thinking, how to write well, those kinds of useful skills as a byproduct of having learned these other subjects. We turn it on its ear. We directly teach useful knowledge. We are particularly interested in critical thinking, creative thinking, and effective communication. And we directly teach that material as the foreground, using content, the usual kind of subject matter, as a vehicle, as a concrete way to teach. So that's one thing that's different. Second thing that's different, which I've already alluded to, is how we teach. We use the science of learning. So we use active learning. In fact, we do something we call fully active learning, where we want 75% of the time, we want all the students to be involved, to be engaged. So people are not just sitting there listening to a lecture. We have no lectures. Moreover, they're not just sitting there in a seminar where one person is talking, everybody else is sitting. Rather, most of the time, everybody is doing something in terms of the interactions that are going on. This is all based on the science of learning. We know that the probably the single most important factor underlying learning is being engaged, thinking things through. The third thing that's different is the means of instruction. We have a software platform that we've developed in-house, which allows us to teach more effectively, but more importantly, allows the students to learn more effectively. We can ask students to vote as part of being engaged and instantly see the results and ask students why they voted the way they did. We can take various kinds of polls. We can have them in breakout groups where small groups meet together at the push of a button to discuss things and then bring them back to the class. We do various techniques such as relays. So the platform has been built with the science of learning in mind. This is an amazing thing. The software group, the engineers, work closely with the academic group so that the technology is tailor-made in the service of teaching and learning effectively. I mean, it's an amazing dynamic with Jonathan Katzman, the head of that group, and his colleagues and my group. So that's the third thing that distinguishes it. So what we teach is different. The way we teach is informed by the science of learning and the means of instruction using this platform, which allows students to learn more effectively. In part, I should mention, by the way, is we give them feedback almost immediately after each class because we've recorded what goes on and it gets scored. And then finally, we're global. We believe that the future is going to involve increasing interactions across national boundaries, and we want our students to be comfortable with different cultures and ways of interacting with people who have different kinds of backgrounds. So this is very different than most places.
Okay, let's take those one at a time. In terms of what you teach, it sounds like really what you're saying is you're trying to teach, correct me if I'm wrong, teach students how to learn, and then they can learn different subjects rather than trying to teach them subjects where they might learn how to think critically through those subjects.
Yes, that's right, but it's a little different. So we're guided by two kinds of things, first principles and empirical findings. So just starting with first principles, we started by asking what do we want our students to be able to do after they graduate. So we had a lot of discussions about this. It could have been different, but we've eventually settled on four goals. We want them to have the wherewithal to develop into leaders. So they won't necessarily be leaders the instant they get out of college, but we want them to be able to develop into leaders, to have the means doing that. Second, we want them to be innovators. We want them to learn to think creatively. Third, we want them to be broad. So we're not doing pre-professional work here. We're not training them to be doctors or business people or something. We're actually giving them the tools to succeed at jobs that don't even exist yet. And then finally, we want them to be global. So we started with those four goals, and then we went to the empirical literature. So there's a lot of studies of leadership and creativity in particular, and looked at characteristics of successful leaders and people who are creative. And we organized those into, it turned out to be three big core competencies, which will surprise no one. One of them is critical thinking, another is creative thinking, and another is effective communication. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to do all three if you're going to be a successful leader, mm-hmm. you're going to be a successful innovator, and you're going to be broad. And the global part is part of being broad, actually. So these analyses led us to define the specific things we teach. So these tools, we call them the great cognitive tools. There are two types. There are what we call habits of mind, which are things you do, like what you do in critical thinking, okay, which we want to become so automatic, they're a habit, become intuitive. So that's one kind of thing. And the other kind of thing is what we call foundational concepts. This is knowledge you can build on for the rest of your life. So we do both kinds of things, teaching these kind of useful skills and teaching foundational knowledge that will help you to be successful after college. And by the way, when I say successful, I mean both professionally and personally. So we're not just interested in giving them these tools to succeed at jobs, but also we want them to have a full life.
So I want to ask you about the communication piece, because I understand no lectures. You know, we all sat through lectures that don't make sense. But a small seminar, you could argue, you're actually interacting with other people and communicating with them in a way you would have to do in the real world, right? You're sitting at a meeting with 12 people. Mm-hmm. You're not actually at on a screen, which is we'll get into that a little bit more about the really cool software that you have. But isn't there an argument that at least some of the learning should be done? They're all living in the same place, so couldn't you just have a room where they do some seminars? Did you think about that and reject it and say, no, everything should be on the computer?
Yeah, we did think about that, and we discovered we can actually teach more effectively and they can learn more effectively with the computer, in part because we can do all these kinds of activities, breakout groups and votes and polls and various other things very efficiently, but also because we record everything and give them feedback. So we can give them the kinds of feedback that are not so easy to do if you just are sitting around in real time. You can go back over and reflect on what you're seeing. So we do that. But I should mention, one of the striking things about our software is you very quickly forget you're on the computer. It just feels like you're interacting with other people. It's all seminars. It's all face-to-face, 15 to 19 people, a professor, full-time faculty member present. And on the platform, you can bring up YouTube videos, you can bring up PowerPoint presentations, you can bring up anything on the desktop of the computer. It can be brought into class, annotated, marked up, discussed, analyzed as part of the teaching process. There's lots and lots of interaction among the students. So I will say, one time we were comparing. We did this systematically last year. The seminar taught around a table versus over the platform, and I noticed something different. I noticed that when it was around the table, if I asked a really hard question, eventually somebody would hazard a guess. They'd try to answer it. But on the platform, they would just sit there. And I realized what was happening is in person, I was making eye contact, mm-hmm. and I would shame somebody. So what we did is the platform now includes the ability...
Has a shaming function?
Well, you can move the cursor across the little thumbnails of each person. Uh-huh. And it expands for the professor so you can see them more clearly. And they see a little eyeball under your icon indicating you're looking at them. And it worked. So actually, we got rid of the eyeball. It seemed a little creepy. And now, mm-hmm. now it just gets a frame around it so you know that the faculty member is looking at you. But that had the same effect. So it is useful sometimes to compare, as part of the development process, the kind of dynamics that occur sitting around a table with what's going on with the computer. But so far, we're just finishing our first semester. So far, the platform is just spectacularly good. It's really doing what we'd hope it'd do.
Okay, we're talking to Stephen Kosslyn, the founding dean of Minerva Schools, a brand new innovative university in San Francisco. You talked a lot about being global. So one question I have, your students are from all over the globe, and you expect them to be even more so as time goes on, and they will spend time in four different international cities. Do students now need to speak English, and then will they be learning other languages as they go to these other countries?
Right. So our language of instruction is English, except for some very specialized courses. And before they go off to another country, they do get an orientation that includes a small vocabulary as well as some cultural information and things like that. But it's up to them if they want to go into depth in terms of learning the language.
Let's talk about who these students are. I know that you are looking to draw a high percentage from outside the U.S. About what percentage of your first class are from the U.S. versus from abroad?
About 20% from the U.S. and 80% from abroad.
And your admissions process is also quite different, not only because of where you're drawing students, but you don't, reading some articles, they talk about how you don't accept the SAT, but then it turns out you have your own test. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So we believe that the problems facing us in the 21st century are so difficult that it's unlikely a single person working alone is going to be able to solve most of them. Instead, people are going to have to work together, and they're going to have to be able to work together with people who are different from them. So what we've done is we've set up a set of admissions criteria to look for students who are really, really good at one kind of thing and very good at everything else and have different profiles. So when they come, there might be one student who's very good at math, another who is a superb musician, another who is a great writer, and so forth. And part of the way we configure breakout groups in some classes is people who have different profiles so that they will interact and complement each other. We think this is a really important skill to learn for the future. So our admissions tests are geared towards selecting the kind of students who we think will do well in our environment.
And what's an example of what's on that admissions test that's different than the SAT or different than other admissions criteria that other schools might use?
We have some non-cognitive tests where we look for things like conscientiousness, maturity, some characteristics like that. But we also look for math ability and verbal ability and some other kind of standard cognitive abilities.
For your students who have come from the United States, what tends to be their background? What parts of the country are they coming from? Obviously, they're people who are willing to try something new.
Yeah, they're actually not from any one part. They're distributed. And what they have in common is they're smart, they're creative, they're open, and they're generally very mature. So that they are capable of functioning in this very novel environment and also traveling to other countries where they'll be studying together.
And you do interviews over Skype and, as I understand it, during those interviews have someone write an essay while on Skype to ensure that it is actually their work. Is that right?
Yeah. So one of the reasons we don't like SATs is if you have enough money, you can hire a tutor who will get your kid 200 points higher. It's got a cultural laden part to it that we're not real fond of. But in addition to that, we worry that sometimes students get help in their standard applications with their essays and not just from relatives. And we wanted to eliminate that. We wanted to judge each person on their own merits. So we ask them to write short little essays online when we have the camera on them as wherever they are in the world. Responding to questions, we have many, many kinds of questions, so you can't know in advance what it is we're likely to ask you about.
What is the gender balance of your first class?
It's biased a little bit towards women, a little bit. We take anybody who's qualified. So one of the really great things about using the platform is that we don't have a limit to the number of seats. We don't have buildings that have specific numbers of seats in them in the lecture hall and so forth. So we take anybody who's qualified. We accept them.
Well, you still have to house them, though, in these expensive cities, though, right?
Yeah, but we rent. So part of what we're up to keep our prices down is we don't own anything except our computers. So we have rented a residence hall on Knob Hill, nice one, and a second one now down on Market Street. And we charge market rates, just what it costs, we pass along.
Okay, well, we'll get to the facilities in a moment. Let's take a quick station break. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the future of higher education and San Francisco's newest university, Minerva, with founding dean Stephen Koslin. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. What do you think about a university without buildings, libraries, or gymnasiums? Do you think tomorrow's leaders can be trained online? If you're in the process of applying to colleges or have a son or daughter applying now, would you consider an innovative school like Minerva? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us or text us at cityvisions@klw.org. or post a comment on our website at klw.org. And let's go to the phones now. We have Bill calling in from San Francisco. Bill, welcome to City Visions.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate and I'm really inspired by the approach that the gentleman is taking with education, mostly because most of the online type of platforms I see really emphasize an undertone of emphasis on training rather than the approach to it, learning and teaching and the expanse of knowledge and thinking and critical thinking. I'm also interested in, since my background is in information communication technology and human-computer interaction, on how the software platform that you're working is accessible to people with disabilities under the Section 508 standards of the ADA and or, you know, WC3 standards and guidelines that are required for colleges that are accredited and receiving federal and state funds, if you are that, if you are accredited and going to receive these types of funds.
Kind of a multi-part question there in a way. Thank you, Bill, for your question. Stephen, go ahead.
So we are accredited through the Western Association of Schools and Colleges, in conjunction with the Keck Graduate Institute, which is one of the Claremonts. So we're incubating with them. But we do not intend to take any federal money. We will not take Title IV. Most of our students are international. It wouldn't really make much of a difference, and it would impose a lot of regulations and so forth. But that said, our goal is to provide education for anyone qualified. And we do intend to address the sorts of issues of accessibility. This is something we've been talking about how to do.
It seems possible that with your platform that it could be more accessible than old buildings and without, you know, elevators and things like that that some universities have.
I hope so.
Yes, well, it really is. It's a great opportunity, and your approach is very, it carries all the gestalt and all the universality of being with it. I can truly appreciate, and building an accessible platform under 508 and or universal design standards or guidelines would really enhance your ability to reach the population. Thank you.
Okay, Bill, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit more about your facilities. So you have all the students living together now, and in future years, they'll be off to other cities. Where are some of the cities that you plan to have this roving university go to?
So next year will be Buenos Aires. Well, actually not next year, the sophomore year. We have a very small pilot class this year, which is helping us debug the program. And in exchange, they have free tuition and free housing. And they are our partners. They're collaborators. They will take a gap year next year, and we have our first real class, and then join that class the year after. So next year, we'll have a much larger class here in San Francisco. The first year is always in San Francisco. And then they'll go to Buenos Aires or to Berlin. And then following that, we're still discussing. They'll be somewhere in Asia, probably somewhere in Africa. Lots of.
Will you go with them, or will you stay here in San Francisco?
At least initially, I think I'm going to have to stay here in San Francisco, but I certainly plan on visiting the different facilities, and at some point hope to be able to spend a substantial amount of time at the different facilities.
And as you have the sophomore year in Buenos Aires, will you then have another freshman year happening here simultaneously?
Yes, exactly.
And where do professors generally live? So all the students are living together, but they're getting it's all online, so a professor could be anywhere, yes?
Exactly right. They can be anywhere.
And where do they tend to be with this first class?
This first class, they're primarily in Southern California or Northern California, though one of our faculty members is French and has to go to France some regularity, and another one has a lab running in Canada, so he goes there with some regularity, which is good. I mean, this year we're really trying all of our systems to see, make sure everything works, so it's good to have people traveling and teaching from different places.
And what about the argument that for professors, and I realize in some universities where professors are lecturing 500 people, you don't develop this relationship anyway, but about developing a face-to-face, in-person relationship with a professor as a mentor?
So I think you can take apart face-to-face versus in-person. If you've spent much time with Skype or Google Hangouts or something like that, you quickly discover that, in fact, you can have face-to-face interactions with people that are not in the same room as you. So that said, because all the students are in San Francisco the first year, we do interact with them in person, and we do have them doing activities in the city. We're not just having them sleep here. We're actually making use of the fact they're in a city as part of the curriculum. But I think the fact is, the technology is now good enough that you can have real face-to-face interactions and develop relationships with people who you interact with over the platform, over technology, especially if you've met them in the flesh first. That seems to be useful for reasons.
Got it. So professors at least do come out for an initial face-to-face meeting.
Yeah, that's the plan. It's certainly been the case so far.
That certainly makes sense. So let's do a quick station break and so then go back to the calls as we have more callers waiting. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing the future of higher education with the founding dean of San Francisco's newest university, Minerva. That founding dean is Stephen Koslin. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to join to call our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website. Now let's go to Elise from Bolinas. Elise, welcome to City Visions.
Hi there. I'm very intrigued by your conversation. I went to a low residency MFA program, and it was a fantastic experience. My question, and I apologize if it has already been answered, why do the students have to live together?
We want them to have a full college experience. So we think part of college is developing friendships, interacting with peers in a concrete setting where you do activities together and things like that. So the first year, we feel strongly they really should live together in San Francisco, where our headquarters is here, we're around. After that, we're discussing being more flexible. We'll see how that evolves.
I know that some smaller, mostly private colleges do require freshmen to live in the dorms their first year, obviously they're freshmen. It just seems that your tuition is so reasonable, but the living cost of living is so expensive in San Francisco, and I could host a student at my house and they could go to your school for $10,000 a year. That just would seem to me to be ideal, but it sounds like you've kind of figured that this would be the best way to go. Anyway, good luck to you. I just helped a student senior apply to college just November 30th, and it's a very nerve-wracking time, and I think wherever he gets in, he's probably not going to be able to go to because of the cost. So, you know, it was an exercise. We wanted him to try. We wanted him to see what he could get with financial aid, but it's quite likely he will end up going to junior college. So anyway, I appreciate what you're doing, and I think it's very valuable.
Well, thank you. And I should say that if we're going to succeed, we have to be able to have students on full scholarships, students who don't have the financial means to be able to pay even the $10,000 a year tuition. So this is part of our current goal is to raise scholarship money. if any listeners are so inclined to want to contribute, please contact me. But if we're going to succeed, we have to allow people like your son to be able to attend.
We have an email. Thank you very much, Elise. We have an email from JP that is right on point that says, have you covered tuition without federal funds? What does that mean about financial aid availability?
Yes, that is so we're actually three organizations. One of them is the Minerva Institute for Scholarship and Research, which is headed by Senator Bob Kerry. And part of what he is doing is raising money for scholarships. and this is challenging in part because we have so many international students. But our goal is to allow any qualified student to attend, and we are really trying very hard to achieve that goal.
Let's talk about the financing. So tuition is $10,000 a year plus room and board, so a total of $28,000. Less than other universities, but still a significant amount. What about this idea of Elise's? What if a student was like, you know what, I can stay in my parents' friend's basement. Would you possibly allow that down the line to allow somebody to come who couldn't afford the $28,000 but could afford the $10,000?
Well, there are trade-offs involved. The cost is clearly one of them, but the other pieces are the kind of experience they have, and we really do want them to have a full college experience. We're not an online university. People sometimes say that. We're not. I mean, we're a hybrid. They live together, and they take their courses online, but they also have co-curriculars and extracurriculars in the cities they're in where they actually do things together. So we think part of becoming a well-rounded person is a result of those kinds of extracurricular, co-curricular activities.
Though some people would argue, you just used the term, I think, full university experience, that, you know, having your professors with you would be equally as important as having other students or having a library where you could all go or having a gym or you name it. So what is it about being with other students that you thought was so important, but these other parts you didn't think were as important?
So part of our goal is, I know this sounds slightly ambitious, to make the world a better place. And we want to develop an international network of students who are very talented and will work together after they graduate to make the world a smarter and wiser place. So in order to have that network evolve organically, naturally, we have to have these students interacting on a daily basis. So that's part of what we're up to here.
Okay. Now, a big part of this, too, is that you are for-profit. You've received, if I'm not mistaken, $25 million in investment. Why go that route? Why not be a nonprofit organization doing all the things that you're doing now?
Well, actually, we're three organizations, and two of them are nonprofit. So the one that I head, the Minerva Schools at KGI, the Keck Graduate Institute, is nonprofit.
Oh, okay.
It is part of Keck Graduate Institute. We're doing the undergraduate programs with them. They are nonprofit, as are we. And the Minerva Institute that Bob Kerry heads is also nonprofit. That's dealing with scholarships and a prize that we give for innovations in research and also helping our faculty do research, get funding, and so forth. The for-profit part is the Minerva Project, and that's developing intellectual property like our software platform, which is, there's nothing else like it. It has lots of potential uses. So the way it works is the Minerva Project licenses free the software to the schools to use, and any developments we do goes back as part of the intellectual property that the
student's tuition is going to which one of those three entities?
So the student's tuition is to cover the faculty costs.
So that goes to the nonprofit that you run or to the for-profit?
It's slightly complicated. It ends up being for the nonprofit, but it goes through, for various accounting reasons, the C-Corp.
So when you read about Minerva, for-profit is how people describe it typically. You're describing a more complicated situation.
Right.
What's the discrepancy there? why do you think people describe it as a for-profit rather than go into kind of the details of it being three different entities?
Well, it's complicated, but also I think people tend to think of Minerva as online, and that brings to mind other universities that are described that way, which are for-profit, and I think that that's unfortunate for us because we get confused with...
Right, there's some bad actors out there, no question about
it. Right, and that's one of the reasons we're not taking Title IV, by the way. They make a lot of money off of government subsidies, and we don't want to do that.
So another challenge to getting started is you have no alumni network to start with, which is key for both fundraising but also for job placement and mentoring.
Right.
Now, I can imagine the people who are going through this, they're innovators, and you would think that, that you're hoping that they will be extremely loyal once they're out in the world and help the next round of innovators behind them. But what about for these first few classes? They're going out there without – you know, without mentors from their university who can help them get started in the world.
Right. Well, not quite right, actually. I mean, the deans that we have, the faculty and various people at Minerva Project have incredibly rich networks, and we are willing to use those to help our students. Moreover, because we are helping the students learn practical knowledge, like critical thinking and creative thinking, effective communication, we expect that employers are very quickly going to realize the value of having these students. So the students will do internships. They have 4 months off during the summer. We have very few holidays. They take 4 months off, so they have a big chunk of time. And what we expect to happen is once employers discover how useful it is to have our students involved, we will develop a second level of network through them.
And is there any internships during the year? You have them positioned in these international cities where a lot of exciting things are going on. Outside of the classroom experience, whether it's internships, trips in the city, service projects, tell me about that.
Right. So we have three kinds of activities the students participate in. The curricular, which is all over this software platform, but also co-curricular, which are optional kinds of activities that are related in some way to the curriculum, and then extracurricular, which are clubs and so forth that they come up with. So we organize these co-curricular events.
Can you give some examples?
Yeah. So, for example, we have a project in our classes to study homelessness in San Francisco where they have to go out and collect some data and analyze the data and come up with some policy recommendations as part of one of the classes. A co-curricular would be meeting someone who's involved, say a minister who has been innovative, and meeting some of the homeless people and talking to them, interacting with them. So it's related to what they learn in class, but it's optional, and it's not part of an assignment. And then you can imagine an extracurricular activity where they might work in a soup kitchen or something, just to, something they want to do. That,
okay. We are speaking with Stephen Coslin, the founding dean at Minerva, San Francisco's newest university, and we invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org. or post a comment on our website at klw.org. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. I'd like to talk to you about the students. We were talking before we went on, and I said, you know, how do you like the students? And you said you love them. Tell me what they're like.
Oh, they're so bright and enthusiastic and open and creative. They really are partners. They're really collaborators in helping us refine our curriculum and further develop this software platform that we're using. They're all different, but they do have in common that they are open and extremely curious and willing to work very hard.
Can you give an example, without naming a name, of one or two students who stand out as particularly interesting or unique to you, like where they're from, kind of what they're interested in studying, things like that?
Sure. So one of the young women from China, is very interested in design, in product design, but she wants to know how design of products can bring out the underlying humanity in people who use the products. She's extremely interested in the role of empathy and community, and how products facilitate or reflect or draw out certain human capacities. So she's interested in data mining to try to understand what it is about products in certain places for certain demographics and so forth that makes them appealing, and how that would fit into the needs of specific populations, for example, in China. But she's also very interested in psychology, perception, comprehension, and so forth, and human factors or product design. Another student comes to mind who carved a canoe out of a single log as a high school student and made his own shoes. And he's interested in living and working on a farm next year during his gap year with a retired professor so he can read books in the morning and discuss them after dinner with the faculty member. They're interesting people. They're really interesting to talk to.
And how does a young high school student in China even know that you guys exist? What kind of recruitment are you doing to get this incredibly international student body?
So we have a managing director on every major landmass who has a team. And these people have made connections with the high school counselors and organizations for high school students that help them apply to colleges and so forth. So we have a very active group that is out there explaining what Minerva is, because we're starting from scratch, so there's no recognition whatsoever. So it's talking to lots and lots of people, lots of parents, lots of students, and encouraging them to find out more and to apply. And it's been very successful. Our first year, we took a tiny class, just 28 students now. We had almost 2,500 applications. So it's really going very well.
Wow. So that is serious work to pare those down, given that you're doing Skype interviews with people. Do you pare some down before you even get to the Skype interviews?
Yes. It's a series of steps that the interviews are at the end.
But your specific test, is that someone everyone takes, or they need to pass through some hoops before they even get to take your test?
It's a sequence. Mm-hmm. There are phases.
Have some students tried it out and said, this just isn't for me?
One.
Got it. We have an email now from Carl who says, Minerva sounds like an exciting and innovative experiment, and I wish it the best. But I think there is still a place for public universities, and I'm a little concerned that Minerva might be used by politicians as a reason to completely defund public universities. Any comments?
I don't think Minerva is for everybody. I think it's for a very specific kind of student, and that in general, it's about fit. That is, if you have a high school student thinking about going to college, I wouldn't recommend thinking about the college per se in its own right. I think about the fit to your student, what the student wants, what the student's interested in, what the college has to offer. And from that perspective, there's always going to be a need for a variety of offerings. And I think public universities play a very important role. It's a different niche than we're occupying. But I don't think we'll ever replace that.
And tell me about the founder and CEO of the for-profit company, Ben Nelson. What is his background, and how did you get to know him?
So Ben was CEO of a company called Snapfish, which was photo finishing.
Sure.
And he sold it to Hewlett-Packard. And then realized he was fairly young that, he'd always been interested in education. As a college student, he had at Wharton School in Penn, he had tried to reform the way education worked and then failed and felt frustrated and never forgot that. And when he had some time after having sold Snapfish, he was able to reflect and come up with this idea. And he was able to then convince Benchmark Capital to give him $25 million to get this thing started.
So there's one primary investor at this point?
Well, at this point, we're in the middle of our Series A, Series B now, and we've raised much more money than that now.
The number to call to join our conversation with Stephen Goslin, the founding dean of Minerva University here in San Francisco, is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. What do you think about a university without buildings, libraries, or gymnasiums? Do you think tomorrow's leaders can be trained online? If you're in the process of applying to colleges or have a child applying now, would you consider a school like Minerva? Again, our number is 415-841-4134. Do you know yet for the next year how many applicants you'll have compared to the first year?
Well, it's clearly going to be a lot more. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're in the process right now of accepting applications, and it's looking quite promising.
And so for next year, how many seats are you trying to fill?
Oh, a couple hundred.
And those all would start in San Francisco?
Yes.
So are you looking for more buildings in San Francisco? That's just got to be a huge challenge given the housing crisis we face here.
Yeah. Rent. We won't buy anything. But, yes, we will be needing to house more students.
And are you going to look to do so in the same area, or might students be spread out in different parts of the city, or too early to tell?
I think it's probably too early to tell.
Okay. And what about scholarship of your faculty? That's another big part, of course, of traditional universities. You are not paying your faculty, as I understand it, to do research, but just to focus on teaching. Of course, one of the big criticisms of a university is you end up getting taught by TAs and not actually by the folks, or they don't care about teaching because they're more interested in research. So tell me more about that, because obviously very important research for the good of humanity gets done at universities, and that doesn't seem to be part of your model.
Oh, actually it is.
Oh, okay.
So we are a research university. So we believe that it's important for faculty to be involved in research so that they're cutting edge and they can teach the most recent material to their students. So we will be supporting faculty research, particularly computationally based research. We have a computational infrastructure, bar none. Our group in engineers is just fantastically good. But we will also be setting up partnerships, part of what the Minerva Institute will do. Is help faculty find local labs or facilities to do their research. And we actually intend to have students be part of that whole enterprise, just like they are at other places where they are involved in the faculty's research.
But wouldn't it be harder in a lab if they're in two different places? For certain things, you would have to have the professors and the students in the same place, yes?
Well,
depending on the type of research.
Less than meets the eye. So these days, a microscope is a screen with a couple cameras. Well, the screen and the cameras don't have to be in the same room. In fact, they don't even have to be in the same continent. So we are building a remote laboratory now at the Keck Graduate Institute, which can be accessed anywhere in the world, where you can actually do experiments. There's one in the UK already, and we're hoping to do a better job in some respects than they've done. But we intend to push this as far as we can, this idea of location doesn't really matter with respect to faculty-student interactions around the curriculum.
And where are you recruiting faculty from? I know you've gotten some very well-respected, high-profile faculty to come. How are you doing that? How are you getting people to give up their very comfortable job at top universities to come to this startup?
Well, there are a lot of people out there a lot of faculty out there who are really interested in students. And the typical American research university is faculty-oriented. As you mentioned, most classes are taught in lectures. And lectures are a really great way to teach because you can teach 1,000 people as easily as 10 people. But they're a terrible way to learn. We know that. There's no question about it at this point. And there are faculty who care. And we are very appealing to faculty who are interested in innovative teaching, and particularly those who would like to live anywhere, because you can teach from anywhere where there's enough bandwidth.
Speaking of lectures and the end of lectures as we know them, the massive open online classes, MOOCs, that is not what you are. And I know you're really trying to differentiate yourselves from those. But as I understand it, you do encourage your students to get kind of foundational information for free from MOOCs. And then you're providing the more advanced, the next level there. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Basically, we use a sort of flipped classroom model where the information transmission is done before class. So they read, they watch MOOCs, they learn certain facts. You have to know something before you can engage in critical thinking about it or creative thinking about it or effectively communicating about it. So the goal of our seminars, and all of our classes are seminars with no lectures, the goal is for students to master information, to be able to think about it in novel ways, to think about it critically, and so that, that it becomes intuitive so they can use it in their lives. That's our goal. So it's very useful for us that MOOCs exist.
And how are students evaluated?
So we have these, our learning goals are well-defined. There are 129 of them currently, which are these habits of mind, things that you do, like involving critical thinking, and foundational concepts. Like
give me some more examples of those. Maybe not all 129, but give me a few.
I'll spare you. So foundational concepts range from how you negotiate with people, how you write clearly, how you analyze what you read, how you present material using visual aids and the like, all the way over to mathematical concepts that are involved in statistics, in simulations, so that the students learn Python programming, and about human biases, so that you, it's hard to catch them, but you can try to catch them after the fact. And in biases and reasoning, among other kinds of things. So there's a whole set of these foundational concepts that are very important. And with respect to the habits of mind, they range from things like sanity checks. When you hear an argument, are the assumptions plausible? Order of magnitude when you do arithmetic or you do something on a calculator, is it kind of in the rough, right area? To evaluating claims, to weighing trade-offs and decisions, so who stands to lose? These things should all become habits of mind. So we have, in each session of each class, there are learning objectives, which are one or two, typically, of these habits of mind or foundational concepts, and they've done some reading to give them a context for it, and then in class, it's all activity-based. They're doing stuff with the information. This is how they're going to absorb it. This is how it's going to become intuitive over time.
And are they being evaluated in the moment? Or do they also take traditional tests later in the semester?
So each of these 129 habits of mind or foundational concepts has a rubric associated with it. A rubric is a rating of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And in order to get a 1, you have to have done the following. In order to get a 2, you have to do a little more than that, all the way up to a 5. So each of these things gets scored, and these rubrics are reliable. Two different people using them should be able to get the same score. So after each class, the professor goes through the recording and scores each student in terms of these rubrics for how well they've used these habits of mind or foundational concepts that are being introduced and practiced in that session. So I should mention that in the first year, we introduced all 129, and after that, they choose a major, more traditional kind of thing, and they get a grade on the content. And crucially, depending on how well they use the habits of mind and foundational concepts, their grade from the first year is adjusted. So if you did relatively poorly, you can get it better by using them later. If you did well and you don't use them later, it's going to be adjusted down. So we want to give them motivation and incentive to really use this information in their thinking and performance.
Now, this way of teaching, using the software and everything effectively, obviously is totally new for the professors you're bringing in. Do you have to provide them with pretty intensive training to get them where they can really use this effectively?
Yes, we're putting together a 6-week training program for the faculty, the last 2 weeks of which will probably be the faculty teaching each other so that they really have hands-on experience with feedback from us. We'll treat them as active learners, just like we treat our students.
And how has it been for the faculty this year? How hard has it been for them to catch on to the software where they're also teaching the students?
There's a learning curve initially, but everyone's now become very comfortable with it. It's the software is probably less difficult than shifting to fully active learning. That is, we all have a tendency to want to lecture. We're professors. But it turns out lecturing is not always the, not always, it's rarely the best way for students to learn.
So this is a pilot class. What is the one thing you learned from this class that you are going to change for the next class?
The one thing. We've learned so much from them. We have gotten focused on the kinds of materials they should read. They should be directly relevant for this habit of mind or foundational concept, which should feed into the activities. We've learned a lot about balance, that the students were working very, very hard. So we've pared down the amount of preparation for each class to 4 hours for each session in advance. It's still quite rigorous, but it was getting more excessive than that. We've learned a lot about how to think about the other kinds of things they do when they're not on the platform. That is, being out in the city, interacting with each other, and so forth. So it's really been a great experience having them here, and it's improved what we're doing immensely.
And you said there's 4 hours of prep for each session. How many sessions do they have per day?
Well, they have four courses this first year. They're year-long courses, each one of which meets twice a week for 70 minutes as a formal seminar with a professor. Then they have a one-hour session that's student-led, where we actually have the students leading it, and we give them feedback afterwards. It's recorded, and we give them feedback about how effectively they led it and so forth. I mean, one of our goals is to help them become leaders. Best way to do that is have them practice being leaders.
Sure. Looking forward 5 years from now, as we close out here, where do you see Minerva being 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
Where, you mean which cities?
Which cities, how big, like what is the impact it would have on changing education? What is the big vision here?
Well, I already mentioned that one of our major goals is to create an international network of creative leaders who will work together, which we think will make the world a better place. But we also hope that we will provide a model for some practices that can be picked up by other universities, including public universities. We hope that we will become the major center for research on higher education. So we will be varying things systematically and seeing what works. And we will be publishing this material and disseminating information, hoping that we can help the ocean rise and all boats will go up.
All right. Well, Steve Koslin, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
That's City Visions for this evening. My guest this evening was Stephen Koslin, founding dean of Minerva Schools. Thanks to all of you for joining us. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Kevin Vance. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper and Susie Britton. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.